Welcome to The Lowdown, KMXT's show dedicated to giving you the up-to-date information we have available on the COVID-19 outbreak and how it's impacting life on Kodiak Island. The Lowdown will focus on facts as provided to us by local and state officials. During this edition of the show, we give you access to local physicians and public health experts with information on COVID-19 and recommendations related to it. If you have a question for our guests, please email it to lowdown@kmxt.org or call KMXT at 486-3181.
Excuse me. Well, look at that. Good morning and welcome to another episode of The Lowdown. I just took a sip of coffee and I guess it hadn't made its way all the way down my throat just yet before I started talking. But here we go with another episode of Doc of the Rock here on The Lowdown. My name is Jared Griffin. And yes, if you have questions, you can give us a call, 486-3181, or shoot us an email. I got the email right up here on my screen, lowdown@kmxt.org, and we will get your questions on the air. Today we have Dr. Shanna Theobald joining us. Good morning, Doc.
Good morning.
There we go. And the other docs, they are either out working or out on vacation. How nice. That must be nice. So let's take a look at the COVID situation right now, and then we will we'll get into it, and we'll get into listener questions that we have. So the latest COVID-19 outbreak is continuing in Kodiak. The EOC reported 16 new cases today, and they'll have another update here in a couple hours. 10 cases were classified as close contact, 5 as community spread, 1 as travel related. We now have, as of yesterday, 112 known active cases locally, with 3 active cases currently hospitalized in Kodiak. We've had a total of 58 local hospitalizations and 5 deaths associated with COVID-19 in the Kodiak Island borough. Right now, more than 618,000 Americans have died from COVID-19, and that's over 4.3 million people have died worldwide. About just under 60% of Americans aged 12 and up are fully vaccinated against COVID-19, according to data released from the CDC. Hospitalizations are at their highest point in 6 months. The daily case average in the United States has surged to more than 110,000. That's a 25% jump just in the last week, according to federal data. The U.S. has reported over 770,000 cases in the last week, marking the highest weekly total in months. And every state in the country is now reporting a high or substantial rate of community transmission, and hospitalizations in the U.S. have climbed to the highest point in 6 months. About 9,300 patients are being admitted each day, and that's the highest since April. So these are not the numbers that we wanted to see, Dr. Theobald. What is concerning to you?
Yeah, that is an excellent summary. And also just knowing that every single one of those people that has been affected or lost a loved one is a person, is a human being, is a family member. And that's a lot of people. I think also looking at the numbers from the EOC, I was kind of crunching the data last night, and we had per week, we had 105 new cases in the last 7 days. The week before that was 51 new cases per 100,000 per day, or so 99 total cases in the last week, 48 cases the week before that, 27 cases the week before that, 25 cases the week before that, and 3 cases. So if you look at that, we are on that exponential kind of doubling our case numbers every week. And that's the pattern that is the most concerning to me, because seeing how this Delta variant has played out in the world first, India was kind of our big, warning country with it, where it originated from, but then also seeing how it's playing out in countries that have low vaccination rates and countries that have high vaccination rates. And now the Lower 48 in Alaska and different communities in Alaska, we are clearly on that trajectory here in Kodiak. And that's where that gives us all, you know, concerns. In clinic locally, we are seeing a lot of really sick patients with this variant. Dr. Kohler has been treating with Regeneron, which is a monoclonal antibody, two monoclonal antibodies that are mixed together to help prevent COVID from progressing to severe symptoms or needing hospitalizations. But he's saying that he, you know, in the last few days when he's been in clinic, he's seeing sicker people than before. And it's more concerning now. And the track we're on, we're not headed into a, in, I'm scared. It feels like dire to say this, but we are not headed into a good position here in Kodiak based on what we're seeing right now.
You had brought up Regeneron. Regeneron treatment, how long have we had that in Kodiak?
Yeah, we just started using, Dr. Kohler got it from the state about 2 weeks ago when we had two severe COVID cases, right when the numbers started in that upward trend, really started exploding. He contacted the state and they said, we have it for free of charge of patients and we want people to use it. There is really, of all the treatments outside, you know, before getting to the hospital that have been studied, Regeneron is the one that has emergency use authorization by the FDA and does show to help decrease hospitalization rates by 70%. Was the studies that I was looking at last night, which is significant. Here's the thing. We know the vaccine reduces the same type of progression to severe illness by a bigger percentage. You get that when you're not sick. Regeneron requires patients to be either in clinic or have a home infusion over an hour and then an hour of observation. So everybody who's getting Regeneron is sick with COVID and in contact with clinic staff for 2 hours, which is, it's over $1,000 per treatment that somebody's paying for. The patient doesn't have to pay for it, which is wonderful.
And somebody is paying for it. I mean, like most likely the government or the...
Insurance companies and the government at this point paying for it. Yeah.
That's an expensive treatment.
It's a very expensive treatment. And I'm glad we have it in our repertoire. And we did have one breakthrough case of an elderly patient who received it. And that felt like, you know, that's exactly the kind of situation that we want to use it in. It also, at the same time, for unvaccinated people who, you know, we have the absolute best prevention as far as safety and efficacy goes. And I still highly encourage people to get the vaccine. The Regeneron is also under investigation. Everything at this point with COVID treatment is under investigation. That doesn't mean that it's not safe or effective. It just means that we're, you know, scientists and medical professionals are looking at all the information and it takes time to gather that information. Mm-hmm. But the Regeneron has been around a lot less time than the vaccine. We have less data for it. There are risks to it. And I still highly recommend people get the vaccine because that is what we know works best. And there's study after study after study showing that.
Mm-hmm. Regeneron is described as an antibody cocktail. What does, what does that mean?
So it's a mix of two different antibodies. And basically, though, they're both targeted towards COVID. They're already made antibodies that have been created in a lab that are already targeted towards COVID. So basically, instead of waiting for your body's immune system to ramp up its immune response and create your own antibodies, you're helping a patient. Basically, what it does is it binds to the virus and inactivates it. And the more antibodies they get, the more viruses are inactivated while their body's learning how to fight it itself.
Let's see. I mean, we've got a lot of topics here today. One thing that a lot of people have we've seen questions on this is kids. This is from KRWG posted yesterday. It is a public radio, public news in New Mexico. Their headline is that nearly 94,000 kids got COVID-19 last week. And they were 15% of all new cases across the nation for the week ending on August 5th. That's about a 31% increase over a week earlier, and then like a almost nearly 100% increase over, you know, the weeks before that. The American Academy of Pediatrics and the Children's Hospital Association said that the new coronavirus cases in children have been increasing in July, after even a period of decline. Now, so the whether the Delta variant is making kids sicker than previous strains, there's still no clear answer on that, but the numbers appear to show that severe illness, hospitalization, and death are rare in children infected with the coronavirus. I think it's like less than 2% of all child COVID-19 cases required hospitalization. And virtually, it's like 0.03% were fatal. But still, the concern is that the growing number of children diagnosed, hospitalized with COVID-19 is putting a strain on an already overburdened pediatric healthcare system. What do you know about that? We don't really have a pediatric healthcare system here, but... When you hear that, when you see that, what do you think?
Yeah, so we have had positive COVID cases here in Kodiak in the last couple of weeks, which is, again, like you said, and like this article suggests, is pretty rare. Children were not as affected as we thought they were going to be. but we're seeing that change now with the Delta variant. Other news articles too from Florida, Mississippi, the South, children hospitalized is increasing significantly, and it is straining the pediatric resources. And the Delta is just so much more infectious that it makes sense that we're seeing kids affected now. And yeah, hopefully it will continue to prove true that it doesn't increase hospitalizations and fatality rates in children. That is always a lagging factor, though, and we're really just exploding into this right now. We don't have great data from India, and they're still trying to synthesize, you know, data from other countries that have high vaccination rates, like the UK and Israel. But unfortunately, it is affecting kids more.
So this article also suggests that adults and parents are choosing to defer medical care. Just like during last winter surge, there was there were some stories about people either forcibly having to defer care because of strained resources, but people, you know, choosing to defer care for themselves and to defer care for their children, not wanting to, right, put the burden on medical resources in their community. What are your thoughts on deferring medical care?
Yeah, that is also an excellent question, and this whole situation is not ideal, obviously. I think at this point, seeing the surge that we're heading to, and also one big thing about the Delta variant, if you look at the pattern where it's played out in many countries, it is a huge surge, but then it also falls off fairly quickly. About a month, several weeks is what it's seeming to last in a lot of countries where it has kind of just raged through like wildfire. And so as far as pediatric care goes now, obviously if your child is sick, if they're sick, get tested. If you're having any symptoms, get tested. Because at this point, we want to know who has what. And people act differently when they know they're COVID positive versus have a common cold. if there's any urgent care that your child needs, you know, make sure you don't hold off on any of that. as far as just preventive care for pediatrics, if, you know, waiting a month to get childhood vaccines while we're in this surge, I think is prudent as well. So anything that's kind of primary and preventive care that can wait, it's probably just better to wait it out at this time because we are getting a lot of sick people. We're trying to screen, you know, we've gone back to the same screening practices where we have people call ahead and then we screen them before they come into the clinic. But people that have been testing positive have been surprised that they have it. And there are people, I mean, with the contagiousness, there are people carrying it around that don't know they have it at this point. And so keeping your kids out of a clinic situation where that is more likely to be an exposure at this point makes sense if they don't have to be there. But if there's any urgent care or you need to be seen, you can always call and have a phone appointment. And also, you know, we kind of triage over the phone too. If there's something clearly that needs to be seen or listened to or examined, we'll have people come in wearing masks, and we'll obviously be wearing masks and take as many protective measures as possible.
So we have a question from a listener about what you're talking about. This time of year, a lot of folks suffer from allergies, which along with there's the common Kodiak crud that seemed to, it seems like it took a year off, but it seemed, but now it's back. And these can have very similar symptoms to COVID symptoms. Do you recommend anyone with certain symptoms go get tested? Or is it any symptom?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. At this point, I would recommend any type of cold symptoms, which do overlap significantly with allergy symptoms, get tested. Partly because our test positivity rate is so high right now. I think we're around 10%, the numbers I saw, which is in the critical, you know, the red zone as far as that's a high number. And a lot of people that are testing positive are surprised that they're positive. That's also an indicating factor that there's a lot more burden of the virus out there than people realize. And so you might think your symptoms are just common viral or common allergy symptoms, and they might be, but it's just so much better to know at this point because we aren't in lockdown mode and people are out and about doing things. And if you have tested positive for COVID, you're going to behave very differently than if you just think you have allergy symptoms and are kind of being cautious, but not quarantining.
So let's talk some more about the vaccines. We have several questions about vaccines too. Locally, have you, maybe you don't have data, but anecdotally, are you seeing an uptick in people coming in to get vaccinated?
Yes, we are definitely seeing an increase in our clinic. I was trying to look at the websites don't show the graph for Kodiak, but I was trying to kind of look at that data and just compare week to week how our percentage has increased. And I think we are in the last week or two seeing, definitely in our clinic numbers, we're seeing an increase in vaccines. And I presume that that is Kodiak wide as well. And it makes a lot of sense. I mean, a lot of people were holding off, were hesitant to kind of see how good the vaccine is over as much time as possible before getting it. B, we were in a lull with COVID. We were doing excellent. We had less than three cases per 100,000, three new cases per 100,000 population per day. And at that point, a lot of people were thinking, you know, maybe we can ride this out and there isn't a reason to get the vaccine. Now that we're seeing the surge, we see how effective the vaccine is against the Delta variant. It really is a big push for the people that were kind of holding out just to wait and see that was what they needed to get in and get vaccinated.
And the CDC just came out with recommendations today for vaccines during pregnancy. They updated their recommendation and based on new evidence that the vaccine officially poses no safety concerns for pregnant people vaccinated even late in pregnancy. No safety concerns for their babies, no safety concerns for increased risk of miscarriage. And the CDC also found no increased risk of miscarriage among people who got vaccinated even during the first trimester. Pregnant people were not initially included in the clinical studies for the vaccine, so the CDC couldn't definitively say that vaccines were safe and effective. But now that we've had the vaccine for so long, the All sorts of women's health organizations have come out in full support of vaccinations for pregnant people. But as of July 31st, only 23% of pregnant people have received one dose of a vaccine during pregnancy.
Yeah. Just to put this out there, that data was not collected lightly. The women who did get vaccinated while they're pregnant, you know, a lot of them were OB-GYNs and really looking closely at the risks versus benefits, and also looking at the risks of getting the COVID viral infection in pregnancy versus the vaccine. And a lot of OB-GYNs that I know of were involved in kind of making these recommendations, and they would not make this recommendation if it wasn't truly safe in pregnancy. And yeah, the data really has been very positive for pregnant women. And if I was pregnant, I would get the vaccine, absolutely. But yeah, so I'm glad that the CDC, you know, we have the data now, and they couldn't include women in the initial trials because it really, at that point, wasn't, we needed to have the safety data before putting two lives at risk. And so that was done. Everything has been done in step, you know, stepwise. And fortunately, we're at the steps now where we can see all the data and make and be able to say, yes, this is safe, really be able to reassure people.
One of the concerns, or maybe not concern, but criticism of the vaccines is that that even if you're vaccinated, you can still be infected or even reinfected. The CDC has said that reinfections among unvaccinated are twice as likely than those who are vaccinated. It reduces the likelihood, I guess, for future infection. What do we know about reinfections at this point?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was really trying to look for data on that last night, and there's just so much information
right, exactly.
to wade through at this point. There's probably a good study out there, and I did see, I think, I want to quote it accurately. Vaccines, we have always known they're not 100% effective. There is definitely breakthrough cases, especially with the Delta variant. It is showing resistance to the vaccines. But vaccines are still excellent at preventing severe illness, hospitalizations, and death from the virus. And right now, it is hands down by far the best tool that we have to both prevent people from getting infected with COVID and also prevent COVID from causing severe illness. And I like get vaccinated. The one thing I can tell people right now is get vaccinated. I will tell you this. There were some patients that came to clinic that were hesitant, and I didn't push the vaccine because I get it. Like, as far as if you are, you know, maybe high risk for having problems from the vaccine as well as the virus, like when you weigh those, obviously we should get the vaccine. But I wasn't pushing it because I listened to my patients and I gave them the information, recommended it, but let them make their decision. Now I'm saying that some of those people got medevaced. Some of them are still suffering from the effects, and they have told me if they could go back and do it again, they wish they would have gotten the vaccine sooner. So that's what I'm telling people now, is that get the vaccine. Don't keep waiting on anything. I mean, right now it's more crystal clear than ever that vaccine is needed. It's protective. Yes, there are breakthrough cases. They're less severe. Yes, there are issues. You know, the vaccine isn't 100% effective. We've always known that. A good vaccine, I think we've talked about this before, is, you know, 70% effective. The flu vaccine is 50% effective. Does it make a difference? Absolutely, 100% it makes a difference. And so the message from public health, epidemiologists, Every doctor who's really looked at the evidence is get vaccinated and don't wait and worry more about getting the virus than getting a breakthrough infection about getting the after getting the vaccine.
And there's also the issue of the waning of immunity after you get the after you get a vaccine. In a study of more than 50,000 patients in the Mayo Clinic Health System, researchers found that The effectiveness of Moderna's vaccine against infection has dropped to 76%. Pre-Delta variant, it was close to 90% earlier on in the year. For Pfizer, the effectiveness has dropped, it seems, even more, had fallen to 42% with the Delta variant from 76%. And so, you know, this kind of brings up questions of booster shots. I think there's a question from someone that also says that, not sure what the source is, but the waning or the effectiveness decreases for the Pfizer vaccine about 5% per month after you get the vaccine, especially in the face of the Delta variant. And so, you know, after 6 months or so. Explain, if you can, explain the waning of immunity, and then we can talk about boosters and things like that. But it does seem like Moderna is holding up a little better than some of the other ones.
Yeah, so there are two factors at play. One is waning immunity to all comers of the COVID virus. So just how good does your immune system maintain that ability to fend off a virus when you're re-exposed? And what we are seeing, the CEO of Pfizer mentioned about, I think his quote was about 6% every 2 months. So after 6 months, about 86% effectiveness or immunity protection after 6 months. And that's to all COVID viruses. But as you mentioned, the variants change the effectiveness of the vaccine at baseline. And Israel actually quoted 39% effectiveness. I believe it was the Pfizer vaccine with the Delta variant. So not only are we seeing waning immunity just in general from our immune systems, kind of basically the best analogy is the military. Like when you're doing the drills and it's fresh in your mind, you're going to be really good at, you know, whatever that combat drill is. And as time goes on, you kind of get rusty and forget how to attack that same way again. That's kind of how I see waning immunity, is that your system is, and it needs a refresher. Yes, booster shots are being very, very diligently discussed at this point.
I read that there were over 1 million unauthorized boosters.
That's exactly right. Yes. And there's a lot of data supporting it. And there is also increasing data showing that it does reactivate your immune system and kind of boost those antibodies back up again to levels that will effectively combat the virus if you're exposed to it. So there's absolutely good evidence for it. The problem at this point is that most of the world has not been vaccinated. And already, you know, wealthy countries that have, there's already a huge inequitable distribution of vaccine to countries that have resources. I think from a public health standpoint, it makes more sense to get the world vaccinated with the first round for the first time than to have booster shots in wealthy countries. I believe it was the WHO, or maybe the UN, or both agencies asked for a moratorium at this point on getting booster shots in wealthy countries, because the most important thing at this point is getting global protection. These variants have spun out of populations where COVID has been allowed to run rampant, and it's in unvaccinated areas that these variants are coming out of. And so that just is another, I mean, the next thing that is dreaded from a public health standpoint is another variant that is even worse than the Delta. So we just need to get everyone vaccinated at this point. And I think, yes, while there is a need for boosters, there's also a need to just get everybody protected.
Yeah, but let's see if we can get through this without going through the entire Greek alphabet. Not sure what would come after. If a vaccinated person does become infected, a breakthrough case, does that confer additional immunity you know, sufficient, you know, for, you know, instead of getting another booster shot. What are we seeing in terms of that?
Yes, absolutely. If someone has already had the COVID infection and gets the vaccine, there's a huge increase in immunity. And you're getting immunity from two different ways. Basically, you're getting it from seeing the virus itself and all the particles that it has shown your system when it infected you. And then also specifically the RNA from the spike protein or the DNA to the spike protein if you're doing the Johnson & Johnson or AstraZeneca vaccines. So you have people that have had both have a higher immunity and decreased risk for reinfection than people who are just getting the vaccine or just getting the infection. At this point, it's really interesting. I was reading last night, people that have gotten the vaccine actually have better immunity to what it looks like the Delta variant at this point than people who have had a prior infection. And of course, getting the vaccine is still highly recommended because the infection itself has so many risks, much, much, much higher risk compared to getting the vaccine. So if there's one message that I can say on the radio today that everyone takes away, get vaccinated, get your friends and family vaccinated. It is, I mean, if you look at we all got the mailer in our post office box from the doctor who, you know, they're making claims like the most highly educated, authoritative doctor on the subject. And if you look into him, first of all, he's misusing credentials that are not true. He's being sued by the Baylor that he's saying he's the medical director for. If you look at his claims, it's so fraught with error. And also he says, nobody knows how the RNA vaccines work. That is not true. We know in and out how these vaccines work, exactly how they work. And the claims he makes are just astounding. He says, no one's taking, you know, people are saying all these things, but no one's taking responsibility to show you why they're making the claim. That is not true. There are many, many, many studies going into the details of why each recommendation is made. And to me, it's concerning. It sounds like he's not educated on what's actually happening. And then, of course, he goes into the conspiracy theories
right.
that this is, you know, Nazi Germany forcing people to take experimental treatments. And it's like, to me, it's just so astounding the nature of what these doctors are saying and so easily disprovable. And if you look them up, their records are extremely flawed. Another doctor that they're using to kind of promote a lot of these anti-vaccine messages has been suspended. His license has been nearly revoked. He's killed people by prescribing. Yeah. So if I can, the other thing is if you get information in your mailbox and it gives you pause. I mean, I had a long conversation with my brother who's in California and he's like, but there's so many doctors saying that the vaccines, you know, have issues and they're concerned and it doesn't take a really deep dive to look into those doctors and to look at the websites where these are being promoted and to start realizing that, unfortunately, there are people with credentials that are that are spreading misinformation, and they're, you know, held as the one person who is
speaking through the noise. Yeah.
Yeah, going against the establishment. That itself is a red flag. If you have one person. Mm-hmm. Based on the hundreds of thousands of studies and doctors and people who are doing a really thorough kind of unbiased, I mean, the bias, you can just see the implicit biases all throughout everything that they're saying. And the other encouraging, and I've had patients call me and we've had this conversation. They're like, yeah, but didn't you read the mailer? And like, this doctor is saying this. And, you know, our conversation goes down that road. And so what I also want to do is just encourage people to really investigate the information that you're getting. Don't just take it for face value, because if you take it for face value, it's really scary. And I get why people have been concerned about it here in Kodiak. And at the same time, it's very easy to kind of uncover. And these doctors are making so much money. I kind of went down this deep dive and I looked at the websites that these are being promoted on and then kind of looked in deeper into these doctors. And it's kind of astounding at how much they're making off of this. And they, yeah, anyway, we've talked about this on every show, and Dr. Jones has been really excellent about just saying this misinformation. It's dangerous. It's harmful.
Right.
It's not good for people. It's not true. If you want truth, really, really kind of look into it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to what extent is this vaccine really experimental? It's really not. We've had, flu vaccines, rhinovirus vaccines for decades. Mm-hmm. And this is what, I mean, COVID is like this. And we've had the vaccine pretty much as soon as the virus was identified, the vaccine was developed, like January 2020, we had the vaccine, but it had to go through the testing anyway. So to what extent is the vaccine really that experimental?
That's a great question. And that's another really big thing that the FDA is looking at right now, giving it full approval. Mm-hmm. They don't want to rush it. They want the science to be able to be looked at, under a microscope and examined thoroughly and to hold up. And that's what is being worked on at this time. So it's not experimental. The word experimental, I think, is a really...
It's a misnomer. It's not quite accurate. Yeah.
Exactly. Or if you're going to use that word, everything is experimental at this point, because COVID is the virus that we're dealing with is a new virus. So ivermectin, all the treatments that are being touted, ivermectin, Regeneron, hydroxychloroquine, all of those were also equally, if you're going to use the word experimental, and also dangerous. The other big thing is people are saying, 45,000 people died within 3 days of getting the COVID vaccine. I went on to VAERS report. I spent a long time last night going on to the VAERS report to really investigate that. And you can pull up all the data. You can say, put in death as a kind of after effect of getting, or something that happened. Basically, this is what happened after you got the vaccine.
Right, yeah.
Whether or not it was caused by the vaccine is not at all one of the kind of indicators that they're looking at. And so, but there was a few hundred people that died within 3 days. I didn't see anything on the measure of 45,000 people dying within 3 days. Mm-hmm. And there have been many thousands of deaths since January, since we've been administering the vaccines to the broad population. But again, those are all deaths that, when you read through it, a lot of them say, this person was 95 years old, was extremely sick, was expected to die, mm-hmm. but they were in the nursing home, they got the vaccine. I mean, you can just really look into all of these claims, and the 45,000 number is an absolute lie. There's nothing supporting it. And, all the investigational journalism that has looked into it has also kind of revealed that. And yet that's still being, every day I talk to patients that are saying, yeah, but 45,000 people died within 3 days of receiving the vaccine because of the sources where that information is coming from. Mm-hmm. So yeah, another thing is just look into those sources. And I'm glad people are bringing up the questions, and we do want to address them.
Another concern among those who are considering but haven't yet gotten the vaccine is that if you get a vaccine and you get infected, your viral load is just as much or is just as high as someone who is unvaccinated and gets COVID. But there's maybe some evidence showing that although the viral load is initially similar to that of an unvaccinated person, that viral load drops precipitously, lowering that risk of transmission. What do we know about the viral load, and how long does an unvaccinated person remain infectious?
Yeah, excellent questions. If you're vaccinated, the viral load does go down a lot more quickly. I do want to, if people are symptomatic, even if you have had the COVID vaccine, isolate, and because you can spread that to other people. And with that, that does explain a lot of probably some of the community transmission that we're seeing. I'm not sure how, so the average infectious periods are, most people that get COVID that are unvaccinated can be infectious for up to 14 days. Most people, by day 10 or 11 is when they're kind of cleared to say they're no longer infectious. is when that viral load starts dropping off. And with the vaccine, I was trying to find this information last night. I didn't find it. It's probably out there. It just takes more investigation. But I didn't see the exact number on how quickly that viral load drops off.
Let's see. I'm just checking and see. Let's move on to... There was have you heard, while we're talking about vaccines and treatments before we move on to the next thing, I saw this morning, and because you've mentioned Israel and their battle with COVID, and so I found this morning. I thought I'd bring it up to you. So they it seems like the Israeli Health Ministry has expanded the use of a COVID-19 treatment called the drug is called Mesencure. It's being tested as part of a phase 1 and 2 trial right now. Basically, it consists of, I'm going to mispronounce this so poorly, which consists of activated mesenchymal stromal cells, MSCs, that are isolated from the tissue of healthy donors. And basically, it's found to reduce inflammation, alleviate respiratory and other symptoms. They tested it on patients between the ages of 45 to 75 with severe symptoms, and 90% of them had comorbidities. And the data showed a 40% decrease in lung inflammation from treatment in the first 5 days after treatment. And then a month later, lung inflammation was all the way down to 1%. Patients showed significantly improved respiratory functions. Oxygen saturation back up to 95%. It seems like they're really going to start pushing this, at least outside of the United States. Have you heard of this, Mesencure?
Just heard of it now from you. And I was kind of looking into it while you're reading it. It looks like it's in phase 2 clinical trials, and they are trying to extend it beyond Israel because it's such a small population size and relatively low numbers of infection at this point. Okay. But yeah, no, that's excellent.
All right. So let's, we've got a few minutes. Let's talk about, the community. Let's talk about traveling. So I'm going to be, taking some kids up to college next week up in Fairbanks. So we're going to be traveling for a little bit. So I'll just read this this question from a listener. What is the reasonable, cautious approach to traveling? Understanding that a person could be symptomatic and still asymptomatic, and still transmit the virus. A traveler might know that they're infected. They can go to the airport, get a test negative, get on the plane. After you arrive at your destination, should you still wait a couple of days to see if symptoms do occur? You don't want to infect grandma or somebody else. So what do you suggest a reasonable, cautious approach to traveling right now?
That's an excellent question. I presume that means for vaccinated people as well. If you're unvaccinated, I think the same travel restrictions that have always been in place should still be in place, which means quarantining for the first up to a week at least before exposing other people. And then if you're vaccinated, at this point with what we know about the Delta and our cases in Alaska, Fairbanks, Anchorage, Kodiak, I would play it much more safe. Now I'd recommend kind of going back to similar protocols that we had before, which would be, quarantine. People with the Delta variant peak with their viral load a lot earlier in about 4 days as compared to 6 to 7 days.
Oh, okay.
So I think waiting for the first 4 to 5 days after travel would be prudent. I know it's hard. You know, most people are going on a trip for a short amount of time and you don't want to lose that time with your family. I'd say at least, you know, mask, wear that N95 mask, wear a mask that is a good fit and really going to protect you and your family if you are going to be around them, and as many other family members that can mask up, the better. And also depends on the vaccination status of your family. Like if everybody's vaccinated, if all the kids can get vaccinated, then great. If they can't get vaccinated, I'd say, you know, even more measure of caution at that point, because that's, yeah, you don't want to bring that infection. It's kind of, if I was a public health official, I would highly recommend going back into only necessary travel for the next month or 2 months. Mm-hmm.
You know, last weekend, some organizations around town canceled their outdoor events: the milk run, the salmon derby. These are outdoor events, and we have a couple of outdoor activities coming up this weekend. Warm August nights out there at the fairgrounds. I think there's even a dog show out at the Baptist Mission. What are your thoughts on attending outdoor events? What are the precautions that we should still be attending to?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. We do know, obviously, that hasn't held true, that outdoors is much safer than indoors. So that's a big thing. And then also, at this point, though, wearing your mask, even if you're outside, especially if you're going to be within 6, but really 10, 20, 30 feet of other people. And I would recommend just not going at this point. A lot of those events were canceled because of the high case numbers and the community transmission. And we're in that doubling rate right now. We're in that high exponential growth and our case numbers are very high. So that tells me that there are a lot of people infected in the community that don't know it yet. And that's what precedes the hospitalizations and the deaths. I was excited to go to a lot of summer events, and I'm canceling a lot of stuff that is just not necessary at this point. It's elective. It's fun. Yes, we need it as a community, as people who are wired for connection. We need all of that. But at this point, knowing what we know about the Delta, I would encourage people to not go to those events. It makes me really sad to say that, and it's really unfortunate. And at the same time, where we're headed is not good. And the hospital resources that are being utilized, and even the clinic resources that are being utilized at this point, we know there's a lag time, and I'm worried mm-hmm. about where we're headed.
Okay. And this kind of dovetails with that. We're still, especially for indoor areas, promoting ventilation. You know, air exchange is a strategy to decrease the likelihood of aerosol transmission, because we know that this is definitely transmitted through the air. It's not really a surface transmission.
Yeah.
You had mentioned you were being kind of a hypothetical public health official. What metrics would you suggest are reasonable in our community to determine when additional mitigation measures should be employed for indoor and outdoor events, restricted capacity, physical distancing, if you want to jump into that?
Yeah, so the CDC has a excellent table. That's the CDC indicators and thresholds for community transmission of COVID-19. They use 2 indicators and they have 4 levels, and the DHSS just published that they're following this model this breakdown as well. And it makes a lot of sense. These are measurable, they're clean cut, and number of new cases per day does tell us what's coming next. So per week, you know, on a weekly average rolling basis, obviously, you know, it varies from day to day. But basically there's low transmission or blue zone, which is 0 to 9 new cases per 100,000 mm-hmm. in 7 days, which is, they've raised that. That used to be less than 5 cases. Moderate transmission, the yellow, is 10 to 49 new cases per 100,000 over 7 days. Substantial or orange level is 50 to 99. And high transmission rate is greater than 100 new cases per 100,000 over 7 day average. And then that's the one factor. The second factor is the percentage of positive tests in the past 7 days. So the same four color zone, it's like a graph with each column is the color zone. So less than 5% percent positivity is a blue zone. Moderate or yellow is 5 to 7.9%. Substantial or orange is 8 to 9.9%, and then high transmission is greater than 10%, or greater than or equal to 10%. So we're in both the red, and then if there's two different factors, color risk. So for example, you know, if we only had 5% test positive, but we had greater than 100 per 100,000 new cases, would still go with the red zone, but we're in the red zone for both of those right now in Kodiak. So.
Okay. All right. I think that we've gotten through all of our listener questions. Is there anything else that you would, that you'd like to add?
Other than, you know, our doctors are unanimously saying we're seeing a lot of COVID transmission now. We're seeing really sick patients, and even doctors that have, you know, been conservative on not thinking or hoping that maybe this isn't as big of a deal, or maybe, you know, COVID isn't that big of a problem for our community, are concerned at this point. So just really understanding where we're coming from as medical professionals. I want to make sure that the community understands we're worried, we're concerned. Public health in Anchorage is more concerned now than they have ever been in this pandemic. Mm. So yeah, taking all of that to heart and just seeing our case numbers, I think will allow us to make better individual decisions, just knowing kind of what's out there.
Thank you, Dr. Shanna Theobald from the Kodiak Island Ambulatory Clinic. Thank you so much for joining us yet again on Doc of the Rock here on The Lowdown.
Thanks so much.
All right, be safe, and stay tuned for, we'll have more episodes of The Lowdown later on this month, but thanks for listening.